Coming up on Inspired, since Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove was a young man, he felt called to put his faith and values into action.
I wanted to do all that I could for Jesus, and I thought that meant I needed to become a Republican politician. So I came here to Washington, D.C.
But witnessing raw power left him disenchanted, in search of another way to live out his faith.
One person from that community and other folks from that world of Christian activists said, if the United States is going to bomb Iraq, we should be there. Not because we can stop it, but because we should be with the people who are being threatened by this so-called Christian war.
And that experience shifted his worldview, taking him back to that belief that changing politics is the answer.
To shift the moral narrative in this country and the priorities in our public life, for Democrats and Republicans, the voices of poor and marginalized people have to come to the center.
That's coming up on Inspired.
One day, I was walking to lunch down the hill at Union Station, you know, at that food court. And this guy who was sitting on the sidewalk, you know, obviously homeless, asked me if I could spare some change, and I ignored the guy. I just kept going because, you know, I was in a hurry and we had narratives to explain people like him, you know, the undeserving poor, the people who need to, you know, get up and help themselves. I've been told things about people like him. But when I was trying to go into Union Station, I was raised on the Bible. I believe in the Holy Spirit. This doesn't happen to me all the time, but this is what happened. I heard Jesus speak to me. In the King James Version I had memorized as a kid, and Jesus said, "Inasmuch as ye did not do it unto the least of these, ye did not do it unto me." And if my people taught me anything, they taught me, when Jesus talks, you got to listen. So I turned around and I went back and talked to the guy.
The decision to turn around, to engage with a homeless man more than 20 years ago, marked a turning point in Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove's faith and politics. Welcome to Inspired, where we explore the beliefs shaping our world. I'm your host, Amber Kahn. This week, we are launching our 2020 Faith and Politics series. Over the next 11 months, we will take a closer look at how people of faith and goodwill from different points of view are engaging in public life. We kick off this series with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. Today, he's a Christian preacher and prolific author, associated with the New Monastic Traditions and the Poor People's Campaign. But that was not always the case. At 17, he worked as a page for the late United States Senator Strom Thurmond, whose legacy includes being one of the most powerful opponents to federal civil rights and voting rights legislation. Wilson traces this journey in what is part spiritual memoir and part call to action for faithful civic engagement in his latest book, Revolution of Values: Reclaiming Public Faith for the Common Good. I sat down with Wilson Hartgrove when he came to Washington the day before he was attending a mass meeting and protest. But before we talk 2020 politics, we back up to the beginning of his story in rural North Carolina.
I was born there in 1980 and raised there out in tobacco country, rural North Carolina. And I've been living in Durham for the last 17 years.
What's kept you there?
I wandered around for a little while I was getting educated and such. And I wanted to come back to North Carolina because in many ways, I felt like my own vocation was in dealing with the ghosts of a past that I had inherited. You know, the mixing of racism and religion and politics in Southern life part of my formation. And I think in many ways has formed this nation in ways that continue to impact all of us. So,
well, what was it like growing up?
Well,
when you say ghost, that's a pretty powerful...
It is a strong word, yeah.
It's a strong word. It has an ominous feeling. It doesn't feel kind and loving.
Yeah.
What were those ghosts?
I grew up in a very loving community.
Okay.
I grew up, you know, rural North Carolina, country music, country cooking, you know, everybody knew everybody, and we all went to church. And there's a lot of that I loved and still love. I also was born at just the moment when the religious right began to target communities like mine for political organizing. And so we were told that to be faithful to our Bible and be pro-life, we needed to be on the side of corporate interests and white power, essentially, and that that could only happen through the Republican Party. And so as a young person growing up in that, I wanted to do all that I could for Jesus, and I thought that meant I needed to become a Republican politician. So
is that what you did?
I tried. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I came here to Washington, D.C. when I was a teenager to page for Senator Strom Thurmond. Oh. And what then was a bit more subtle racism than we experience now in Republican politics. Nevertheless, you know, the first thing Strom Thurmond said to me, you know, in the late 90s in Washington, D.C. was, you know, take care of yourself, son. This is a dangerous town. So if it was black, it was dangerous. And that was just assumed, like it was assumed that somebody from a place like where I was from would understand that.
So there's a lot of code.
There was a lot of code words. Yeah. For me, it was a stark realization that my people had been sold this bill of goods, right? This offer to give us a way to live out our faith that really had very little to do with our faith, and that in many ways was contradicting what I felt like was at the heart of our faith. But I didn't know any other way to be faithful in public. So I felt like I was kind of at a dead end. I was 17 years old when I went back home, confused and unsure what I was going to do. But I knew I was no longer going to be a Republican politician for Jesus.
At 17?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, my proximity to the raw power politics made me uncomfortable. I went faithfully, because I thought it was what I was supposed to do. I went faithfully to the Senate Bible study, which was led at the time by, you know, Lloyd John Ogilvie, who was chaplain of the Senate. He offered great Bible studies, and nobody from my office was there. None of these staffers went to these Bible studies. I just observed, you know, what people were obsessed with. And it was always about, you know, figuring out how the liberals were trying to get us and making sure we stayed in power. And then one day I was walking to lunch down the hill at Union Station, you know, at that food court. And this guy who was sitting on the sidewalk, you know, obviously homeless, asked me if I could spare some change. And I ignored the guy. I just kept going because, you know, I was in a hurry and we had narratives to explain people like him, you know, the undeserving poor, the people who need to, you know, get up and help themselves. I've been told things about people like him. But when I was trying to go into Union Station, I was raised on the Bible. I believe in the Holy Spirit. This doesn't happen to me all the time, but this is what happened. I heard Jesus speak to me. In the King James Version I had memorized as a kid, and Jesus said, "Inasmuch as ye did not do it unto the least of these, ye did not do it unto me." And if my people taught me anything, they taught me, when Jesus talks, you got to listen. So I turned around and I went back and talked to the guy. And
were you scared?
Yeah, I was scared. And very uncertain. Like, what do you do? I had no idea. But for me, it was a turning point. It was a moment of realization that the sort of discomfort that I had felt inside of me was actually leading to actions that I was uncomfortable with, right? That I didn't want to keep going on this path. And so I think that was the beginning of the end of my political career.
Mm. Or the beginning of a different one.
Of a different kind, that's right. Yeah.
How did he respond when you approached him? Do you remember?
I don't think I did very much. I think I said hi and gave him some money. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. But it left you with a feeling.
Yeah. It left me with a feeling that I had to go back and read the Bible again, right? I had to question what I had thought I already knew. And back home in North Carolina, I met this pastor of a church in Goldsboro, another town in North Carolina, named the Reverend William Barber, who had a very different way of reading the Bible. And he told me that his daddy had taught him that there's no way to read the Bible without also working for justice in public life. And it was an awakening for me, like a realization that there are other ways of being Christian. Mm. And I think that has shaped the rest of my life.
African-American ministers must have been part of your landscape growing up, were they not?
Only abstractly. I mean, only that, you know, I knew there were black churches, you know, out there.
Had you ever
never
gone
went
to them?
You
never
no,
went to them.
No. You know, the racial segregation in church was completely assumed to be normal.
And this is the 1990s?
This was the so-called post-racial America, right?
Yeah,
this is
right.
The America in which my mama taught me you don't see color. Mm. We don't see color. You know, everybody's the same. We don't see color. but we go to church with all the people who are white. and black folks go to church with people who are black. And nobody questioned that. So
you meet William Barber. And yeah. What shifts?
What I realized was that black people read the Bible differently because black people experience America differently. And that was a revelation. And I think it took me a while to get this, but this was equally important, that to experience America as an African American and read the Bible in that context is to understand its good news for this country in a way that is actually good news for all of us. And so the black church wasn't just for black people. It was, in many ways, a way through which I could hear the good news of this text, not just for me, but for my people too. Like, to begin to realize that the great lie of racism and the way that racism got wound up with religion in this country was the belief that I could somehow be good and righteous in my whiteness in a way that separated me from black folks, and that then made me believe that sort of, you know, voting with and standing with these people who look like me was somehow good for me, when as a matter of fact, it's not very good for many people in this country, right? That the pitting of white versus black is a way of keeping most people in this country divided, and that's kind of what racism has always done. And that my religion was being used to do that when it was no longer, you know, politically correct to be explicitly racist.
Did you walk away from religion and Christianity at that point? I mean, a lot of people who I've talked to grew up during that period of time say, you know, when I confronted a hypocrisy between what I was taught and then when I discovered something about that message that violated itself at its core, I lost faith in the institution altogether.
Yeah.
What happened for you?
I want to say to people who've had that experience, I say this, you know, as a minister in the church, that I completely understand. And I think that's a reasonable response. It was not my response. And I think the reason is because, largely because I had parents who loved me really well and who were always sort of open to this questioning. And I was never fundamentally rejected by the people who I knew best within the faith.
And did they embrace what you were embracing?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that made a difference.
And not just my parents, my home church. I went after I met William Barber.
Yeah, you meet William Barber. Let's back up for a second. You meet William Barber, and then what happens?
I went to my pastor. His son was my best friend, and his son was with me when we met Reverend Barber. And we went back to his house and said to his dad, "We met this great preacher. You should have him preach at our church." And he said, "Great, invite him." So our churches actually started a relationship. And there's lots of people there who definitely have not ended up in the same place I have. Mm-hmm. But I think their openness and willingness to let me learn and pursue that made it possible for me to remain Christian. Yeah.
When William Barber came to the church and spoke, what was the reaction of the congregation?
People experienced what almost anyone I've ever heard him preach experiences, which is a sort of, wow, that's a powerful message, and that's good news to me. And I don't think people initially realized that it in any way challenged their political assumptions.
That's
now,
what I was wondering.
You know, some of those people who I've continued to be in relationship with for the last 25 years know that we're close friends now, and, you know, see him on TV and say, you know, "What's he down there protesting about?" And I say, "Well, you should listen, because it hurts you too." I think it's important to recognize that while faith is always political, it's also about something that is deeper and in some ways more fulsome than politics. It's something that encompasses, I think, all of life, and politics is part of that. But I think people can connect with that in ways that are powerful and deep and true. And I lament that that isn't always, you know, transformative for people. People end up in different places. That's part of what democracy is about.
Sure.
But
religious freedom.
And what religious freedom is about. Yeah.
I want to unpack something, though, that you just said.
Yeah.
you said messages of faith that say speak truth to power, address injustice. And we're not just talking about Christianity, mm-hmm. right? Do good in the world, repair the world. That is an inherently political message, because to do that, you're talking about power, the distribution of power, who's making choices, who has access to resources, who has access to wealth, how the most marginalized are treated. And when you talk about fundamentally at a granular level how you're going to address it, those are policies. Those policies are political. And when faith voices come into the political context, they are political. But what is the distinction, or what's the boundary between that and what repelled you?
Well, I don't think the religious right was wrong to say that faith is political. I think it was wrong to tell me that my faith-based political interests were with corporate greed and racist tradition that pits people against one another. I think it endorsed a kind of politics that were fundamentally anti-Christian, because they were anti-democratic and hurt my neighbors, right? So there wasn't, if I took seriously what Jesus said, when Jesus says, love your neighbor as you love yourself, I couldn't keep going with this political program that I came to believe really was a sort of bait and switch, right? We're going to give you a way to live out your values in public. And then when you look at it more closely, you realize that most of those values are actually contradicted by the very policies that are being endorsed. But they didn't want to talk about those, right? They always wanted to focus on a very narrow set of issues that were sort of the bait. And that was usually in terms of life issues, right? Calling it pro-life. And it helped me to actually get to know some very faithful women who talked about reproductive justice in ways that, like, it was obvious to me that they cared about life. It was obvious to me that they, you know, affirmed life. Many of them were, you know, mothers and advocates for other people, and, you know, did a lot to affirm life, but had been demonized by this whole pro-life narrative that had been crafted to sort of pit us against them in this struggle that I realized was really about holding on to power that, in my context, had been controlled for decades by explicit racism, but they could no longer use explicit racism. So they found ways to talk to the same people that had voted for them, you know, with the sort of racist bait in terms of their values.
Facing the stark conclusion left Wilson Hartgrove confused about where to go next and in search of meaning. Coming up after the break, Wilson Hartgrove heads to Iraq during the Second Gulf War. This is Inspired. Stay with us. I hope you're enjoying this week's show. I wanted to take a short break to tell you a few things about Inspired that you may not know. Our show was founded by a nun named Maureen Fiedler, who in the days after 9/11 saw a need for a national broadcast that would explore the rich diversity of beliefs among Americans. Since then, our commitment to creating and producing compelling radio has never wavered, nor has our commitment to making it available to everyone for free. No paywalls ever. But it's not free to produce this show, and we don't receive any funds from National Public Radio or the local stations that carry us. So I need to ask you for your support. If you enjoy Inspired, if you value it and count on it, please consider donating today. You can do that on our website at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. And thank you for your support. Now, back to the show. Welcome back to Inspired. I'm your host, Amber Khan. If you are just joining us, this week marks the beginning of our Faith in Politics 2020 series that will explore the different ways people of faith and goodwill are working to influence the decisions voters make at the polls and the issues candidates champion. This week, we hear from Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. Earlier, he described his disillusionment after working as a page for the late Senator Strom Thurmond. From a personal encounter with a homeless man to witnessing a chasm between the values espoused and the political power exercised, Wilson Hartgrove returns home, wrestling with uncertainty about the path forward, and learns about his own faith in some unlikely places on the other side of the world.
I think at 16, I felt very certain about what I was going to be. And after that, really since then, I've not been real clear about what the destination is, but have, you know, felt like moving forward in conversation with people I was learning from and who really were helping me sort of see this tradition. Before I went to college, I went and spent a year in Germany with the federal government had a program that paid for young people to do an exchange year in Germany. This has happened since World War II. It's kind of a exchange program. And well, what was striking to me when I was there, in light of what I was learning, was that I realized that religious nationalism wasn't just something I had experienced, right? That it was a very present reality for folks there. I sat at Christmas dinner with the grandfather of the family I lived with, and he talked to me about growing up in the Hitler Youth, and he started crying and said, I didn't realize, you know, what I was being told was so evil until, you know, later. But he's weeping about this, and I think in his tears, I recognize that, like, we have that in common, right? Like, we both were, like, raised up in something that we realized was really, really evil. It was hurting other people. I think that realization made me want to find a way to be Christian back in my own context that could be good news, particularly for people who I knew had been hurt by the bad religion that I had inherited. And yeah, that initially for me meant spending a lot of time in kind of direct service stuff that the church does, you know.
What does that look like? Missionary work or?
Yeah, I did a lot of missionary work.
I mean, good news I think of as evangelizing and missionary.
Well.
Is it? For you?
I think I've come to feel that spreading good news is much more about participating in things that people understand to bless them than it is telling people, you know, a story that you think is good news for them. But at that time, I did a lot of both. I mean, I did what was available.
That's honest of you. I appreciate that.
In terms of the church world. Yeah, we were, you know, we were digging latrines and, you know, rebuilding houses. And, you know, doing skits to tell the gospel story with the kids in the afternoon. But that increasingly led me to communities of people where folks were trying to flesh out the gospel, to sort of live it out. Like, what does it mean not to, you know, tell the story to somebody else, but to live into it ourselves? And I was really drawn to these intentional discipleship communities that were in the tradition of, you know, Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker and Clarence Jordan's Koinonia Farm down in southwest Georgia, which was in the Baptist tradition, you know, this group of folks who had lived interracially in the 1940s to kind of be a witness to some alternative to racial segregation.
And what drew you to those communities? I mean, what was it?
Well, I met the people. I was looking for ways to live out the gospel. I met the people who lived this way, and I thought, oh, well, that, you know, that makes sense.
Did you join one?
Yeah.
What was that like? Where was it?
Well, initially it was in Philadelphia where I was studying. I came across a community called The Simple Way. It was just down the street from a Catholic Worker community. And these were folks who were sharing life together in a hospitality house, you know, inviting neighbors who became homeless for some reason to come in and share life with them, share meals, have a place to stay, you know, addressing education issues in the community, tutoring kids, you know, doing food programs, those kind of things.
What was that experience like to be a part of an intentional community?
Well, it was a powerful thing. I was moved by those people, by their witness, but I was also learning a lot from, you know, the relationships that were possible in a place like that, right? Like, you know, people who were coming home from prison and learning about how, you know, the mass incarceration system worked, you know, learning about just structural injustice in cities and those kind of things. And so I think the very sort of personal journey to try to find a way to live out my faith brought me into relationship with people who were facing systemic injustice. And that kind of brought me back around to the political question. This was right when, like 9/11 happened and, a war with Afghanistan and Iraq began. And so, I was newly married at the time. I met my wife in this, you know, community of folks who were trying to live this way.
Was she doing the same thing you were doing?
She sort of led me to these folks. We were talking about this stuff in college, and she said, "Oh, I know these people who are, you know, living in community." And so, yeah, she helped me find like a practical way to flesh out some of the things.
She's like, "Okay, Jonathan, yeah, you want to put these words to practice? I'm going to test you out here. We're going to go to Philly and live with these folks. Yeah. We're going to come up close and personal to the folks that we think we know."
Yeah. And then we met these people who, one person from that community and other folks kind of from that world of sort of, you know, Christian activists who said, if the United States is going to bomb Iraq, we should be there. Not because we can stop it, but because we should be with the people who are, you know, being threatened by this so-called, you know, Christian war.
Because at the time, crusader language was being used.
A lot. Yeah. We felt like, as people from that tradition, we had a responsibility to bear some witness to an alternative. So we ended up joining.
Did you go to Iraq?
Yeah, we joined this group called the Christian Peacemaker Teams and went to Iraq. And
I want to say that again because you said it quickly. The Christian Peacemakers Team, CPT.
Yeah, CPT, that's right. And they were working in coalition with some other groups from the U.S. and the U.K. and other places, but basically building up a witness of people who were just in solidarity with everyday citizens in Baghdad. So we were there during the Shock and Awe campaign and this, you know, bombardment of this city. And
what did you learn from that experience?
It was, again, a stark realization that, you know, at my home church, you know, with people who knew me and loved me, they were having prayer services for our troops in the Middle East, and they were praying for success in this war. And I'm, you know, under these bombs with people who are praying for their lives, you know, that they'll survive. And it was another recognition that our faith can be weaponized in really dangerous ways to persuade us that it's a good and righteous thing to do something that is just damnable.
For a community to pray for the men and women in armed forces, is that something that you felt like they shouldn't have been doing?
No, not. I understood why they were praying for the troops. Many of them had children over there who were troops or grandkids. It was the way in which our faith had not given us any tools to challenge the policy decisions that had not only put millions of Iraqis in harm's way, but had also put these young people from our community in harm's way. Not for, you know, in my understanding, genuine national security interest, but because of greed, right? Ultimately because, you know, some people wanted to have more control over the oil. And
oil production in Kuwait.
Sure.
Yeah. And later it was discovered that the pretext for justifying the war was actually unfounded. What I almost hear you saying is that what you were doing there and the humanity that was near you in Iraq and in these places was not seen.
Yeah. 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 And that I don't think it's a human deficiency of the people who are praying. I think it's a deficiency of these systems that have taught people, through Christian nationalism, to believe that, you know, you can trust that God is at work through these leaders who say that they're representing, you know, what is good and what is righteous, and that they have, you know, reviewed the evidence and that they're, you know, acting in everyone's best interests. I think that's a con game. It's a con game that people who say that they're representing my values and, you know, working for good in the world are, as a matter of fact, serving the interests of oil companies and hurting a lot of people while they do it. People in Iraq and young, poor people, mostly from, you know, communities like the one where I grew up, who signed up for the military believing they were going to serve God and country.
How did you make sense of it?
Yeah. I think that I ultimately found a lot of hope in the realization that there were communities of people who realized that something was wrong and were working to build, you know, another world, to build other ways of being. And, I just kept meeting more and more of those people. I mean, I had met this black-led freedom struggle that Reverend Barber and others in North Carolina were part of. Now I also, you know these sort of Catholic peace tradition, these Muslim peacemakers, these, you know, Jewish voices for peace. There are people in various traditions who recognize this and are working together to build coalitions that can offer an alternative. And I knew that that was a sort of David versus Goliath struggle, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, these are not the groups that have the money or the power often, but I think I was also beginning to understand, even within my own faith, that the story I had inherited is a story of, a story where the people who in that position trust the truth force of doing what's right, in the long term win. So that gave me hope.
Coming up after the break, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove describes the new moral narrative of the Poor People's Campaign and his focus on reaching Southern white evangelical Christians. This is Inspired. Stay with us. Welcome back to Inspired. I'm your host, Amber Kahn. This week, we kick off our 2020 Faith in Politics series with an in-depth conversation with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. A member of what is described as New Monasticism, Wilson Hartgrove is a Christian preacher from Durham, North Carolina. Earlier, he described his journey from being a devout follower of Republican evangelical Christianity to becoming disillusioned and exploring different expressions of putting his faith into action. From living in a Dorothy Day-inspired intentional community to joining the Christian peacekeeping teams to bear witness in Iraq during the Second Gulf War, to returning to North Carolina to begin his ministry and open a hospitality house, working and teaching and supporting the Poor People's Campaign. We pick up our conversation here. What is the goal of the campaign in the 2020 election season?
Well, I'm part of a campaign that believes that to shift the moral narrative in this country and the priorities in our public life, for Democrats and Republicans, the voices of poor and marginalized people have to come to the center, right? So there are 140 million people who are poor and low wealth. That's about 43% of the country. And in the last election, 40% of eligible voters didn't vote. And a lot of times people get scolded and blamed for that, but a lot of those people didn't vote because they didn't see any way that voting would potentially help them.
Or make a difference
in their
lives.
Difference, right. Yeah. So why bother? I believe that the moral and political crisis that we're in as a country has to be addressed by engaging a lot of people who've come to believe that this country can't serve them, right? And that means a massive expansion of democracy. So that's the movement that I'm part of. I'm part of that movement, you know, as an evangelical who grew up in the South and, you know, who ministers in Southern churches and, you know, writes books for church folks. And in that context, I want to talk to my people about sort of how we've been deceived and how we can recognize that we actually have a lot more in common with and to, you know, work we can do together with this broad coalition of folks who are finding a voice through this movement than this, very narrow, corporately funded, regressive nationalist movement that we got caught up in through the religious right. So I think that's kind of my ministry right now. I want to help particularly white Christians recognize that that a movement like the Poor People's Campaign is good news for us, too. We should be part of it.
Is the Poor People's Campaign perceived as a people of color movement?
I think that's the lie, right, that poor people are black and brown. That's what white people have been told for a long time. When, as a matter of fact, you know, the majority of poor people in this country are white and female. So the face of poverty in America is a white woman, just in terms of the, you know, largest numbers. But, you know, white people have been told that's a problem with those people. And that.
And that's what the prosperity gospel? Do you trace that to the prosperity gospel?
It's partly the prosperity gospel, because the prosperity gospel is a misreading of scripture that says, you know, if you do right, God blesses you. If you do wrong, if you are poor, it's your fault.
Yeah.
I think the influence of the prosperity gospel has grown and is growing.
Talk about that for a second.
I think it's a distorted theology that has lined up with the current form of American capitalism, right? It sort of goes along with it. It's no accident that the faith advisor to the current president is a prosperity gospel preacher, right?
And that would be Paula White.
Paula White, yeah. I mean, folks like Paula White, you know, even when I was growing up, were sort of marginal within Christian communities. But through mega churches and, you know, Christian TV and radio ministries, those folks have had a more prominent voice.
Being able to amplify a different kind of bully pulpit.
Yeah.
And without drawing judgment, there are those who embrace the prosperity gospel, you know, as their valid interpretation of Christianity. Do you think we should have a space in which we can say, yeah, okay, you can engage and believe in that way?
People should be free to believe whatever they want to believe, but this isn't about freedom of belief.
What is it about?
I think this is about the manipulation of people's belief, right? The prosperity gospel, it ain't just something that came up out of a Bible study, you know, among people who were reading these texts.
Where did it come from?
It was cultivated very intentionally. This is going back all the way to the 1930s as a counter to the New Deal. The social Christianity that was saying government has a responsibility to take care of people was countered by people who invested in this prosperity gospel as a way of convincing poor people to support a system that doesn't even help them. So that kind of exploitation, I think, should be challenged, whereas, you know, people are still free to believe whatever they want.
So people are free to believe whatever they want. You are an evangelical minister from North Carolina who's going to use the voice and platform you have to point out and highlight where you see the inconsistencies.
Mm-hmm.
And does it work? Have you found success in what you're doing?
Yes.
You hesitated there. Why'd you hesitate?
I don't want to pretend that that success, you know, can be measured in all the conventional ways, I guess is what I'm saying. So
Okay. We're
not building, you know, churches full of thousands of people that are rejecting the prosperity gospel and now, you know, gathering all together every week to celebrate. That's right.
Okay.
That's right. But what I know is that most Christians in America worship in churches like the one where I worship, where, you know, there are 100 or 150 people there every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a place where, you know, people who are tied into the community in all sorts of ways, reflect on their faith and how that impacts the community. And that's actually been the experience of, you know, most people of faith throughout the history of the world. And it's the experience of most Christians in America today. So what I want to do is to lift up that witness and to say God can work through small things to transform the world, and that we don't have to be caught up in sort of trying to reproduce an alternative version of the distortions that we've been given. I'm not saying to the people who raised me, you're not Christian. I'm saying many of you were deceived by people who were fundamentally serving their own interests, and it hurt other people, and frankly, it hurt a lot of you. And I know you well enough to know that you really do believe those scriptures. So let's go read them again. You know, mm-hmm. When Jesus talks about in the end, the nations are going to be judged by this question. When I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was sick, you know, did you take care of me? When I was in prison, did you visit me? That's not just about, you know, your church ministry or your personal decision. That's about how nations are judged. And if we don't find a way to live out our faith in public, we're not only watching, you know, democracy crumble, but we're also seeing that that's a terrible Christian witness. I mean, Christians have to grapple with the reality that in all of our traditions, the young people are leaving, largely when you ask them, because they say Christians are a bunch of hypocrites. Mm-hmm. Like, the people who raised me are a bunch of hypocrites.
Well, the evangelical churches are struggling.
Yeah, for sure.
With numbers.
And we used to blame it in our churches. We used to blame it on the liberal theology of the mainline and Catholic folks. We'd say, you know, our churches are growing. Well, that's not true. They're leaving ours just as fast now. And again, when you ask people, they say, because I associate Christianity with being anti-gay, you know, bigoted, mm-hmm. angry, and nationalist. And a lot of people, you know, who go out in the world and recognize that that's not good for a lot of people they actually know, don't want to be part of that.
And that reaction of young people within Christianity is also a trend that we see among young people in other traditions in mm-hmm. which they have not confronted some of those issues mm-hmm. in a way that young people are satisfied with.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to turn to other traditions for a second, Jonathan. Your work, it sounds to me like you're speaking to your, and I hate using this reference, but you've used it a couple times, your people.
Yeah.
You're talking to your people.
Aren't
we all? Are you talking to my people? Like, I'm curious, like, how do you interact with people of faith and no faith mm-hmm. from other traditions outside the many, 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 many streams of Christianity?
Yeah.
You know, we are a multi-faith, pluralistic society. We have more interfaith, multi-faith marriages happening, mm-hmm. more young people behaving and borrowing from indigenous traditions and finding syncretic practices to blend with maybe their family's tradition, or leaving tradition altogether and viewing it through a cultural lens and identifying as agnostic or atheist. How do you relate to and work with the rest of the folk out there?
Well, I'm always learning from people of other traditions, and I'm really grateful for that. You know, I'm a better Christian than I would be otherwise, at least in part, because Muslims in Iraq showed me hospitality, which I think about every day. And I live in a hospitality house that's named after a town in Iraq called Rutba. Mm. So I think about their witness to us and what they taught us every day. It's where I live. I also think, for me and for people like me, it's really important to recognize that was part of my story too, that I hadn't fully realized that, like, within the text, within the scriptures that I inherited as a Christian, over and over again, there's a reminder that God is at work through all these other people too, right? Jesus preaches his first sermon in Nazareth and says, I've come to proclaim good news for the poor. And everybody says, oh, that's good. And then Jesus says, now let me remind you, it's often been the case that people who are not like us have been more faithful than people like us. And he does that reminds them of two stories in their history. And then it says they tried to throw him off the cliff in town. Like, that's the end of that story, because that's always an unwelcome message in religious communities, which, so I understand why, like, that part of my tradition wasn't emphasized by the people who raised me. But I actually think it's really good news. It's really good news that God shows up in all kinds of ways, and that, like, we can grow closer to God by listening to our neighbors who know God in different ways. That doesn't make me less Christian.
I have heard, however, more often from evangelical Christians, a real wrestling and concern that if my engagement mm-hmm. is not with the objective of evangelizing and sharing the news of my beliefs, then my engagement is not acceptable. I've been told that in private conversations and in interviews I've done, where there's a real wrestling with that message that's come from different leadership places and in theological seminaries. So
I'm completely familiar with what you're saying.
You are. I just wanted to check.
As someone who grew up in the tradition and is still part of it, what I say to people in that tradition is that's not evangelical at all. That's whiteness in the American context, and that's colonialism, right? It's this notion that we have what's right, and we have to either change you into what's right or get rid of you. we inherited that from colonialism. And it was mixed up with religion, too. You know, the missionaries came over here on the slave ships. They came over here with the doctrine of discovery in hand, you know, from a pope who had said, convert them or get rid of them. That was basically the mandate. And that's poisonous. It's poisonous. So I think to the extent that that has shaped our vision of what it means to share good news in the world, we need to repent of it. Yeah. And I don't think that makes me less evangelical.
Well, that's what I was going to ask.
Again,
you.
I think that's the good news.
So that and that
so that's what I preach.
More evangelical. How many folks really and truly in your community believe the way you believe?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's your analysis? What's your take?
White evangelicals, as a political group in this country, have been very carefully groomed and shaped with a sort of wraparound message for 40 years. And I'm a realist. Like, I get it. If you talk about that 81% of people who, you know, voted for Donald Trump in 2016, many of them are going to do it again. That is true.
Yeah.
And I think that knowing a lot of those people, I know that a lot of them are deeply troubled by it. A lot of them recognize that there are internal contradictions to it. And I think a lot of them are desperate for another narrative. And
what does that mean? What do you mean by that?
My belief is that left by themselves with their own troubled thoughts, people will continue to do the same thing that they've done in the past. I think given the opportunity to be part of a community where they can learn a different way of understanding their own tradition, I know people will change because I've seen it. So that's my calling. I feel called to help create spaces where people like that can come to understand a different way of being Christian. I'm not going to promise that that's going to radically change percentages, you know, but I think it is like a generational effort. And I think we've come to this place because hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars have been invested in making that just normal for people. And the only way to create a new normal is to invite people into something else.
Mm. Jonathan, tell me the name of your book.
It's called Revolution of Values.
And how can folks find it if they want to learn more about it?
Wherever books are sold.
Wherever books are sold. Revolution of Values. Thank you so much for joining me on Inspired.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any predictions you want to share about what you see happening with people of faith at the primary ballot box?
Well, I'm very encouraged by people of faith who recognize that faith can lead them to vote not just for their own interests or their own values, but for the common good, for, you know, the good of others. And I see people organizing to do that in ways. And I would encourage people who are going to the ballot to think about, you know, not only, you know, what do I think would be good for me, but if you're voting as a person of faith at this moment in our country, what would be good for my neighbor, particularly my vulnerable neighbor who has been impacted by policies that are hurting folks. You don't tell your kids, you know, when you're out there on the playground, beat the others up. That's the only way you're going to win. You know, we recognize that yes, raw power is, you know, sometimes more effective at holding on to power, but there's a greater objective here. And I ultimately believe the only way we can have a thriving democracy is to actually practice democracy. And that means practicing the virtues of democracy. And I think that very much means we have to learn how to respect other people and deal with the plurality. So I'm all for being part of a coalition that's sort of gangly and has all sorts of, you know, difficult relationships, because that's what being human is.
Messy and yeah. Complicated.
Yeah.
Any last comments that you want to share before we sign off?
Well, I would only encourage people to learn more about the Poor People's Campaign, this national call for a moral revival that I'm part of, and that I've learned so much from. Most of the stories that I tell in this new book are people that I've met through that campaign, and you can learn more about it at poorpeoplescampaign.org, and you can show up, because the Poor People's Campaign is in almost every state now, and it's organizing in local communities, connecting together coalitions of people. And we're going to be back in Washington, D.C. here June 20th for a mass moral march on Washington. So hope folks can join us for that, too.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
That was Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, Christian preacher, prolific author, and activist in the Poor People's Campaign. He described his encounter with the Reverend Dr. William Barber II and how that offered him a new way of understanding Christianity and engaging in public life. We're going to end the program with an excerpt of a sermon from the Reverend Dr. Barber delivered at Riverside Church in New York City.
Hope will come out of despair if we dare to speak. Speak with our marching. Speak with our protesting. Speak with our litigating in the court. Speak with our going to jail. If we speak, a new army will rise. A new nonviolent army coming up out of the graves, coming up out of the dry bone. All I stop by to tell you is somebody hurting my brother, and it's gone on far too long, and we can't be silent anymore. Somebody's hurting my sister, and somebody's hurting the Muslims, and somebody's hurting gay people, and somebody's hurting the poor, and somebody's hurting the immigrants, and somebody's hurting black people, and somebody's hurting the children, and somebody's warmongering, somebody's trying to take health care, somebody's trying to take voting rights, and we won't be silent anymore. We can't be silent anymore. We shall not be silent anymore. We must not be silent anymore, because silence is not an option.
That's all for this week. A special thanks to MC Yogi and our founder, Maureen Fiedler. This week's producer was Kevin McCarthy. I'm your host, Amber Kahn. If you missed any part of the show or want to take another listen, head over to interfaithradio.org, sign up for our newsletter and the podcast, and explore our archive. Inspired is a production of Interfaith Voices, a listener-supported nonprofit dedicated to fostering understanding. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.